Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Thriving Minds podcast. I'm Professor Selena Bartlett, and today I'm joined by David Lee, who himself has his own podcast called Dreamers, Achievers, and Believers. And we met on his podcast, and we struck up an amazing conversation that I thought not just his audience, but my audience also would really enjoy hearing not only David's story, but what he's learned from interviewing people that are, you know, dreaming about doing things differently, believing in something else, and then setting that in motion, which is called achieving. And through that conversation, we learned so many things that kind of are so interesting about what we can do to make change. So thank you, David, for joining us, and I'm sure the audience would love to hear your story.
Thanks, Professor Bartlett. Really, really happy to be on the show and really excited. Absolutely honoured. As you said, my name is David Lee. Basically, my story is I started lying to the police. I went into the military and life was good. I was achieving at a high level. I got to experience a lot of things that a lot of people didn't and wouldn't be able to. I really got into adventure sports. I was into a lot of, I was into abseiling, I was into canyoning, I was into parachuting, all that sort of stuff. So it was kind of like a natural progression to go into that area. So I went in there and I thrived. I became a detective. I was working in a lot of high profile cases and things were going well. Then I kind of started to get a few intrusive thoughts about some of the not so nice things that I witnessed and I saw throughout my service. And then I kind of noticed that my confidence was starting to wane a little bit. But around about the same time, I was involved in a fairly hefty firefight. And during that time, there were rounds flying everywhere, and it was a firefight. And at the end of it, we had a debrief, and I noticed that my hand was dead still, that I had none of the fight or flight feelings. I had none of the sweaty palms. My heart rate seemed really, really normal. And to me, I thought, oh, what a gun. I'm that much of a professional that I can do this and it doesn't affect me.
Yes.
It wasn't until years later that I realized what I was doing was totally taking myself away from out of that area. I was totally disassociating what was going on, mm-hmm. which I didn't realize at the time was a bad thing. So then it finally got to a point where, for want of a better term, I just lost it. I lost my emotions. I lost my confidence. My confidence was zero. I used to be someone who would bring it on. Bring it on. I can take this on. I'm alpha male. I can get it all done. Then series of setbacks and setbacks and setbacks. After a couple of years, I was discharged medically unfit, and then I had to reinvent my life. During that time, a few of the doctors basically said that my chances of going back into society, my chances of going back into a job was virtually nil. So here I was at one stage, this person who was operating on a high level, and I started my law degree. I was thinking about becoming a lawyer, and then all of a sudden, just nothing. So then I started to rebuild my life, and I was told that not to expect to go back to the level that I was prior to my PTSD. So to say that to me is akin to waving a red rag at a bull. I went, no, I am going to beat this. I'm going to do the best that I possibly can to get back to whatever level I can. I just didn't know what level that was. So I basically did what a lot of the doctors did. I was lucky enough to be treated by a doctor who I'll speak about if I can. And then I started to rebuild myself. So at one stage, my wife would come home of an afternoon. She would be in the driveway. She'd hit the horn, and that was a sign for me to basically look out the window. If I looked out the window, she knew everything was fine, so she'd come in with the kids. If there was no me at the window, then the kids were staying in the car. She was going in because I wasn't in a good spot. I was not in a good place at all.
Right.
So after I did a lot of the rebuilding and the rehab that I had to do. I had my my flirtation with drugs and alcohol as a matter of self-medication. My doctor at the time said, look, David, what I want you to do is whatever level you get back to, I don't want us then to be having to battle addiction issues. So, yep, a lot of my peers at the time were doing it. So I removed myself from from those peers. I basically removed myself from a lot of it and then started building myself up. And then I was always into high performance. I was always into motivation. I was always into mindset. So then now I'm lucky enough to turn it into a career. And I help people with their mindset. I help people with their businesses, their own personal lives. I'm a speaker as well. And as you mentioned, a podcast host. So now I've immersed myself in the world of high achieving and also mindset.
So can I just say congratulations on that journey?
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I'm sure knowing your background, you've read David Goggins' book, You Can't Hurt Me, yes, which is exactly, it feels like you're just done a David Goggins, if you don't mind me saying.
Not at all.
And I love his audiobook, and it's not to be the macho extreme version of neuroplasticity, but it's the example of any, like, despite the situation that happens, because what you described to in your situation is completely real. What happened to you is completely real, and that's a completely normal brain response to those situations that you're in, right? Without having to be able to put the shields around your brain to protect yourself through all of those different things you just described, the brain keeps the score, is what I like to say. The brain keeps the memories, mm-hmm. It keeps all of those things. So it's a really, really clever machine. So having to switch that mindset, I mean, it's unfortunate in some ways that we have to go to that level to be able to switch out of it. And some people never do, as the doctors, some doctors said to you. But I mean, I think you would have to say, David, not everyone is like you. They're not all high performers. They're not all, and this is not to say that no one can do it. I'm just saying that some people listen to these stories, and I've got the same story as you. And then they look at us and say, but you're like that. It's not like that, is it, David? There are some moments that you and I could describe equally of when we couldn't get out of bed or didn't think this was ever going to change, but there was something that changed, absolutely. Whether it's the support system or, you know, you might want to describe those moments, because I think that's the key here, is to help other people see that this is them, they're remarkable too. But it's like, how do we help them feel that enough to allow them to take that big step out of the spiral, I like to call it.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether whether a lot of it has to do, and I mean, I think most people are aware of mindset, that a baby is born, it's not born with a mindset. A baby and a child has its mindset, for want of a better term, installed in them through their peers and their family. Doesn't mean that your past has to equal your future. And I know that's a bit of a cliche, but if you truly want to improve, whether it be PTSD, whether it be depression, whether it be whatever it is, you need to take certain steps. And if you don't start taking those steps towards that journey, then you're never going to get out of the situation that you're in. And as you said, I'm not saying that I'm better than anybody else. You're not saying you're better than anybody else. But the will has to be in you. And once you get that will out, then you can start taking those little micro steps and improving.
Yeah, so let's just stop there for a second. I like that word, because micro step. And I've interviewed someone who talks about micro adventures before she did the big thing, like rowing across the Pacific. She had micro adventures, like sleeping in the backyard in a tent where she felt safe. So I think this micro steps is because you can't change your life or make these big changes without taking the first micro step. And it can be simple as, from a brain perspective.
Exactly. Interesting thing that my doctor said as well. He said that many of the organizations, what they're doing is imagine that they get their motor cars, their vehicles, and they take all the instruments out of them and they weld shut the bonnet and then they drive them. And then after 3 months, 4 months, whatever the case may be, they break down. They just leave them to one side and then go and get some new ones. And ostensibly, I think that's what a lot of the organizations are doing. They're not putting in those service, for want of a better term, steps yes. along the way to make sure that the person's mental health is strong and remains strong.
So the interesting thing in this conversation is when you think, I love the car analogy, and I'm sure many people relate to this, but everyone knows that if you service your car, especially in the beginning, the first few years, it ends up running much longer and better than if you've never serviced your car. It's really well known, isn't it?
It is. Yet people won't do it. They'll go and get their car serviced, but they won't service themselves. They won't check their diet. They won't check their stress levels. They won't check anything about their body. And then when it finally comes and they start getting the prescriptions for all the different medications, a lot of the times they could probably, I'm certainly not a doctor, and I'm not saying that I'm a doctor or a medical expert, but a lot of the times I'm sure that they could reduce their cholesterol or reduce their blood pressure through natural means.
Basis of how you, what's the fishing rod you use to invite people into this belief idea and mindset?
I think it's like any organization that once you get a group of like-minded people together, then that like-mindedness grows. So it becomes almost like groupthink. So if you've got a situation where, I mean, Wim Hof is a perfect example. And Wim Hof is basically a Dutchman who believes in cold water therapy, breath therapy. And for a long time, he was just considered a bit of a sideshow, a bit of a freak show. He's quite eccentric, and he actually went to the scientific world and said, I've had these sense of modalities, test me on them. I believe something, there's something in it. And I think initially, you may be able to confirm this, I think mm-hmm. initially he was kind of passed off as being a bit of a circus act, a bit of a
30 years. He's a 30-year overnight success.
So I think that's a prime example of the group thing that can happen in any different sort of organizational group of people. And I think you have to break out of that and open your mind up to the world of possibilities. I have so many people that I know who talk of mindset as a load of baloney. They don't believe that your mindset is going to change the way that you operate all your life in one iota. So they've got that really closed mindset. It's not an open mindset.
And where do you think that comes from in your opinion?
I think that comes from, I think it comes from certain people are attracted to certain occupations, certain professions, and like-minded people tend to go to it, and then it just becomes all-encompassing.
Right.
All-encompassing.
Can you describe that for yourself, seeing like because you were drawn into a, like for someone outside like myself, what is the thing that draws you into those?
The thing that drew me into it was the fact that you could challenge yourself. I, throughout my life, and even now, I like challenging myself. Where there was no coincidence that when I went into those areas that I volunteered for some of the most hazardous duties. And I suppose you could psychoanalyze me to say that, well, it was something in your childhood that caused you to do that. And what caused me to get involved in motor racing, in motorcycles, in canyoning, abseiling, parachuting, not kind of run-of-the-mill things. So was it something that I developed as a result of the way that I was brought up, or is it something in the way I was brought up that developed into being attracted to those activities? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we do now know that we inherit multiple generations of mindsets. not just our own, and we're not born a blank slate. We do know that now. So you could have had something from your, you know, many generations ago that was more risk-taking, like the adrenaline rush, liked the challenge. You know, there's lots of reasons that could explain that outside just your immediate circle of influence.
Okay, well. That's interesting. Because I know that it's epigenetics, isn't it? Is that what
Now it's transgenerational epigenetic inheritance.
Okay.
Generations back and potentially three generations. So these changes you're making to lead in this upward trajectory of your life, or whatever you want to call it, more thriving, doesn't necessarily have to be upward, but you know, the fact that you want to get up and live and help other people, that in my mind is thriving.
Yes, of course.
And but then you're changing three generations going forward by doing that as well.
Isn't it amazing? Absolutely amazing.
It is
amazing.
It's a whole new world. We didn't know this until recently. And the other thing with Wim Hof is we didn't have the techniques and tools to actually demonstrate everything that we've seen inside his brain now until not that long ago in history. So that's the other thing. It's the first time we can see inside the brain in history.
Okay.
Living human brain. Yeah.
The results of some of that research is just mind-boggling.
Yeah, the thing for the audience, because I don't know if we covered it very well, but you'd love this because you're going to go to Poland, walk up that icy mountain. Dr. Dwaga told me that the amazing result from their scientific mind is that they had all of these measuring his skin temperature changes, because he was in a bodysuit from a bomb site and they could change the temperature rapidly to measure the brain changes. But the thing that they were shocked by is that Wim's skin temperature did not change in response to huge changes in temperature. They've never seen that before, and that's his area of expertise, is actually looking at temperature regulation. They were just blown away by that result alone, let alone looking at what was happening in his brain.
Absolutely. It's almost incomprehensible.
But he has trained, you know, 40, but it's from my perspective now, as someone that's studied the brain for a really long time, it makes complete sense to me, because now we can see the subconscious, the autonomic. He's rewriting the medical textbooks, and it hasn't been alone in this. It's been going on in Eastern medicine for a while too. And Dr. Dwarka talks about that, because he was talking about how Eastern medicine does this kind of dynamic meditation where you're disrupting disrupting a system that's really, you know, static, which is what we're talking about, mindset. And then you have to do something extreme to disrupt it. And that's what the ice exposure does, and these breathing exercises and all of these other things that you've tried too.
Amazing. It was when I started going down that path as well, I had a real aversion to cold water.
Me too.
Yeah. It's a funny story, but during my training, one of the things we had to do was a swim. So in typical fashion, they decided to do our swim test at 4 a.m. in the morning in the middle of winter.
Of course.
So we were woken up at about 3 a.m. We were told there's a job on. Get ready. There's a job on.
Where were you, by the way?
We were in, it was in Sydney. It was in Mosman.
Right.
There was a whole bunch of barracks there, and that's where the headquarters was. And so we didn't know where we were going. So we ended up going probably a kilometer and a half away to Clifton Gardens, which is a
I know that one.
So for those who aren't familiar, it's a enclosed swimming pool or swimming area within Sydney Harbour. And Sydney Harbour is renowned for its bull sharks. There's bull sharks everywhere. And it's a lot of people think of Sydney as being a warm climate. During wintertime, it can get pretty cold. So we got down there and they said, okay, guys, we're going to be doing the swim test. And I forget what it was. It was 400 metres in full fatigues. So the first lot got in there, then they got out, they in the past, none of them drowned, thankfully. And then they said, oh, look, unfortunately, we only have six set of greens, six set of fatigues. So the next lot, you lot, strip off, get into those and put them on. So it was like freezing cold, 3 a.m. in the morning, and we had to put these dripping wet fatigues on. So I had this such a, we're talking about mindset, I had this this closed mindset about cold. Yeah, it was amazing, amazing. And now I can jump in a cold shower, I can jump in an ice bath and actually enjoy it.
Yeah. Can I ask you, how did you handle that stress test? How did you get yourself through it? Just grit.
just pure grit. I had a goal at the end that I wanted to get, so I knew that I had to do it. And I also had the mindset of, similar to David Goggins speaks in his book, throw it at me. Throw it at me. You're not going to beat me.
Yeah.
Whatever you do to me, anything short of killing me, I'm going to survive.
Yeah.
So throw it at me. Throw it at me. Yeah. And that's the way I got through it. And when I read David's book, I could really, really understand his mindset at the time. I mean, going through the stuff that he went through with Hell Week, which is there that I think they go a full week without sleep. And I mean, I think the longest I've gone is about 3 days without sleep, not through choice. But it's interesting to see how people will change, how
It affects me.
People will become quiet. Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing all the different
ways. It's definitely torture.
Oh, it is, without a doubt. Without a doubt, yeah.
So let's talk about the people you've been interviewing, because I'm really keen to hear about how you started your podcast and why you titled it that way, and what was the journey that led to that.
Okay, my mind is a sponge. I want to learn as much as I can about as many things as I can. I'll quite often pick a subject or pick a topic that I have absolutely no interest in. And I will listen to a podcast or attend a lecture just to keep my mind open. And I started listening to a lot of podcasts. And there's one particular podcast that I listened to, and I thought, oh, I really like this way that he gets to speak with some really incredible people and educate people free of charge and help people out. And I thought, well, what I want to do now is I want to help as many people as I can with their lives, with their businesses, to live the best life they possibly can. So I thought, what a great way of doing it than getting a podcast. So I thought of a lot of titles, and I thought, okay, people that achieve, people that push the boundaries tend to be dreamers. They dream of something better in life, or they dream of a goal. They believe in that goal. So without that belief or that mindset, people are never going to achieve anything. I mean, would you have become a professor if you didn't really have that love for what you were doing and wanting to achieve at a high level within your area?
No.
Of course not.
Well, no.
No. And then what is the last thing that those three things do? They become achievers. So I thought dreamers, believers, and high achievers were a perfect name for it. So that's how I came up with that name. And I just want to put a bit of a caveat on it, is that when I talk about high achievers, I'm not just specifically speaking about CEOs, professors, speakers, sports people. I'm talking about anybody who is going against the odds and is achieving greatness in their life. And that could be the person down the road who has come from a bad background, has no education, but achieves in their life to a high extent within their own lives. So I'm certainly not dissing anybody or not saying that one person's achievement is better than another person's achievement. We all achieve in our own way. But I have just as much respect for the person that achieves at a high level, no matter where they started from.
Absolutely.
So that's how I started it. And then I basically just started doing the hard yards. I just started contacting people saying, you know, this is a concept of the show. Love to have you on. Love to have you on. Love to have you on. Then started getting a few more higher profile guests. And then from there, it's just recently, it's just kind of exploded. So I feel blessed that I get to speak to these people very, very often, that we normally not only do we speak with the podcast, but quite often, as you would know yourself, you get to chat with them before and after the podcast, and you get to know them a lot. I just feel really, really blessed to be in that position that I can speak to so many of these people. And speaking about mindset, I know we're kind of really reinforcing it, but I will say to them, you know, what is the one thing that you can say helped with what you've done? Oh, mindset. Oh, mindset. Oh, mindset. They all speak of mindset.
Yeah. And I'd like to add to, from a neuroscience perspective, mindset in my mind is training the brain like a muscle. And anyone can achieve that with like going to the, like you understand this, you go to the gym and you get strong arms. But how many people are thinking that their brain's like a muscle? And it's still, you can strengthen the brain without thinking about your mindset. And it leads to a better mindset because all of a sudden the brain's feeling better. It's stronger. It starts to look for things that help drive this mindset. Because sometimes with when we, if we just think about mindset, some people think they either have one or they don't. And Carol Dweck did this a lot around fixed versus growth mindset for learning. And showing people that have a growth mindset like yourself, they end up doing a lot better than someone that just has a fixed mindset. But I look at it even one step before that and think about, imagine if we could show people the power of a brain muscle first, and that their little morning routine, like I said to you, squeezing someone's hand or helping them see outside a window to take a panoramic view first, is something that's building a better mindset for, without them having to think about doing that. You know what I mean? It's the step that comes before in terms of brain thinking, start thinking about the brain and its health rather, and fitness rather than you're good or bad, or you don't do this or you don't do that.
Yes, I completely agree. Completely agree. And it's really interesting when you said about opening the window and taking a good look around. There's a gentleman by the name of Andrew Huberman, Professor Andrew Huberman. Yep. He has spoken about that as well. And I look at that there's people out there that are actually doing that. There's people that are taking on board what science is telling us. Then I go down to the local store and walk past a hotel. And there's a plethora of people on the sidewalk, smoking, drinking, eating fish and chips, and I just think, what is with that mindset that people know that those three things are really bad?
What you're asking is, how can we help people? How do we reach
help themselves?
well, it's a societal thing too, right? How do we get the society to see? It's not the individual's fault too.
Yeah, exactly. There was an interesting, I saw an interesting presentation by Dr. Hannah Critchlow. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her her stuff. She's written a couple of books. She's out of the UK. And I can't remember exactly, unfortunately, the name of her book, but she talks about exactly what you're speaking about now, how... so much of not a person's past, but their ancestral past affects the today.
Yeah,
which is absolutely. Yeah, it's
absolutely
phenomenal. It's
and
phenomenal.
even back before human species, like we came from bacteria and mushrooms and plants, and we have the same circuitry in the brain that a cat has that escapes from a snake, for example. We have the same one, or something more human, but we have. That's how basic that circuit is and why it detects all of these things and treats it all as threats and things like that. So, you know, it's a complicated answer to the question to how we make those societal level changes, but it takes a society that cares enough to ask those questions and think about the systems. And I think Australia is pretty lucky actually compared to many countries where we do try and take care of people that are vulnerable. So of all the interviews you've done, David, what have been some of the great takeaways and people that you've interviewed that have really inspired you?
I think there's a woman out of Atlanta. She came from her name's Dr. Susan Nicholas. She came from a terrible poverty-ridden background. Her grandmother ran a brothel. She had all sorts of obstacles in her way. She went through life and she ended up going to, not Harvard, I'm trying to think of the other university, but she studied, she became a cardiothoracic surgeon. She discovered, or she just felt an emptiness and a void. She attempted suicide. Then she came back, pivoted, rebuilt herself, and moved on, and now helps people in the medical industry and also business pivot and move on to other areas. Her story was amazing. With the podcast I did with her, whenever we do a podcast, there's always a few things that we take out, a few arms, pregnant pauses, things like that, where I decided with Dr. Susan to just air it as it was, air it raw, because it was such a really emotive, strong episode. I loved it. It was one of the best ones I did. One of the other interesting ones I did as well was interview the CEO of the Australian Antarctic Science Foundation, and a gentleman by the name of Andrew Kelly. And he spoke of a lot of the great research that Australia is doing in the Antarctic region. I found that one to be absolutely fabulous as well. But really, I'm finding it hard to really pinpoint, because every guest has a story behind them. Every guest has something unique that they've overcome, whether it be schooling, whether it be disease, whether it be a tragedy in their life. I interviewed a gentleman whose son was killed when he was 18. He has now reformed much of the legislation in Australia, and he basically was the first person ever in the world to organize a meeting with his son's killers. So he organized a meeting with them, went into the room, discussed with them, spoke with them, and actually formed a connection with his son's own killer. And he has done a lot of reform around the world in relation to the way victims are treated. And although he's done that, so much of that, he also believes that victims of crime shouldn't become victims. So many of them use the tragedy that's happened to them and almost build their self-identity on what they went through. And I believe some of that may also be true with people who have PTSD, have depression, anxiety, whatever the case may be, that they kind of identify with that, and that becomes their own blueprint, for want of a better term. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree completely about that, and that's really, really some of the reason I have my podcast. Is because neuroplasticity is the concept that you say it's cliche to say moving forward, but neuroplasticity is that word that means the brain can move forward, but do we want it to? And it's and that's where we get back to the mindset and belief idea, and thinking about the brain like a muscle that can be trained to move forward, but it does like to stay back. It does like to stay in the thing that keeps it feeling safe. Because those stories make us, at least we understand the story, at least we have now something to think about reasons why. So it's, and it's not to dismiss anything that's ever happened to people, because what you talked about, Susan Nicholas and all of these people, is real. That is real stuff. Yeah. And it's, and you can't deny it that it's very hard what people go through. But what we're trying to help, what we're trying to do is say, yes, it is really hard. And it's very important to acknowledge that pain, but then it's also important after a time, okay, so now we don't want to stay there too, because the brain will stay there. And then that becomes a reinforcing deep spiral. And the harder we go down into that spiral, we end up finding other things too that go with us to keep us there. And then makes making this, what you call dreaming, believing, and achieving much harder to the steps. I like to think of as steps or a ladder. Mm. It makes the ladder get higher and higher to get out of. Whereas, and that's why I kind of like prevention or all of these tools of technology we have to help people see things that even if it is that they just wake up tomorrow morning and look out the window and they do it for every morning for the next year. And then all of a sudden they wake up in the morning and go, oh, I'm really happy. Or, you know, that to me is achieving. Because not only achieving for yourself to be grateful for breathing and because being alive has enough purpose. I think we get lost in the having to have all of these accolades or other things, and that means that you've achieved. But as you said, our idea of achieving is the ultimately it's just being alive is a big achievement.
But one
that's really overlooked.
Agree wholeheartedly. And I urge anybody who's listening to go down the path of cold water immersion, water therapy. I think you'll get so much out of it. And I'm not for 1 minute suggesting that you go down to the local gas station and buy 4 bags of ice, come home, throw it in the bath and jump in. I'm not suggesting that that's how you start the practice. But the brain and the health and the anti-inflammation benefits you'll get from it are just incredible.
What I try and do is tell people to, at the end of a warm shower, just switch to cold and then start with your toes and then go to your ankles and then your knees and then you go a little bit longer until you got your whole spine immersed, and then the back of your neck is so powerful for the way this thing can work on your brainstem. And the other thing about this cold therapy or immersion is it's a disruptor to static system. And without disrupting a pattern you're talking about how do we break these cycles, how do we get people to shift their mindset, change their belief, this cold therapy is just a simple tool that you can use to, it'll help do it for you.
Yeah, definitely. And that's amazing. That is exactly how I started it.
Yeah,
that's
me
exactly
too.
How I started it. Yeah, I was really, I had so much trepidation about it, but I pushed myself through it. And I remember when I first went in for the total cold, my breathing, I just almost started to panic.
Yeah.
Now I kind of almost enjoy it. I almost enjoy the fact that I can control my breathing. I can control my reaction to it.
But you've built
it's really
up.
It's so empowering.
Well, you've built it up, haven't you? You've built up the mechanism in your brain through brain training. Mm. It's neuroplasticity. It's not willpower. Mm. It's brain power that you've been building up over time. And it also, the thing I like about it too, it allows you to say to yourself, "Wow, I had a this is me. I'm talking about me. This I had a belief about this cold. I was completely wrong. I end up training myself to this. What else is there? There must be so many things. There have been, I already know, in my life where I end up in a cul-de-sac of thinking.
For sure. I remember when I first started speaking and up on stage in front of 50 people, I was physically shaking. Now, I'm someone who has been fired upon, has fired upon, and I've been in all sorts of high-risk situations. But to think that my brain was actually causing me to react in the way that I was shaking, I had dry mouth, sweaty palms, simply for speaking to 30 people who I don't know, whose opinions of me that probably doesn't even care one iota, yet I was petrified. Now give me 300 people, give me 1,000 people, and I actually enjoy it. I enjoy the event. I enjoy getting up and sharing. It's amazing what the brain can do, as you said, with the neuroplasticity and learning. It's just amazing.
It's incredible. So I think this brings us to, we just have to have this conversation about the cerebellar exercises you were doing. We became into this common ground. You were mentioning a doctor that really, just by chance you said it, helped you. And then we just discussed what you were doing. Do you want to describe what you were doing and what you noticed there was a shift taking? Were you already on the cold therapy before this, or did the shift take place?
No, No, that was just that was years before the cold therapy. Basically, I was in the depths of PTSD. Put it bluntly, I was a mess.
Can you
The
describe
only
a little
time
bit about, if it doesn't affect you, to describe for people that don't know what that means, what that would be like for
absolutely.
you? Does it mean that you're frozen, or do you have terrible thoughts, or you can't sleep, or?
All of the above. Basically, what PTSD is it can be a single event or it can be a series of events. And you can imagine someone in military, police, emergency services, doctors, a lot of people, they have an onslaught, for want of a better term, of trauma. And it builds up over time. You look at the average person, works on a gauge of 0 to 10. They may have an incredibly stressful day where everything goes wrong. They may lose deals. They may do, it's just that, in their words, a terrible day. It might get up to 5 or 6. Then they'll go home, they'll relax, and it comes back down to 1 or 2. People in those sort of high risk situations, they start the day 8. So they go out there and it just builds on from there, builds on from there, builds on from there. So I was working at that kind of ultra high level, and it wasn't a good thing. It was a stress thing, and
How many years was this, would you be saying, to working at that?
would have been about 17 years
Yeah.
or longer. So you're basically on this high alert all the time, that your flight and flight never gets turned off. You're constantly switched on. You're constantly switched on. I remember doing an exercise with a psychologist where she said, "Today, David, we're going to go for a walk from my office down to the street. We'll buy a drink and then come back." So she said, "What I want you to do is I want you to tell me what you're seeing, and through your lens, what is happening now." And a van pulling up next to us wasn't someone, a tradesman picking up. That was a threat. It was a threat. It was dark windows. Who is it? What is it? What could be happening? What are they doing? Walking up to a crossing, and there was a whole bunch of bushes to the left-hand side, that was hiding what was behind it. It wasn't a bunch of bushes in a park. It was a possible ambush site. So that's how I was looking at things. So when I would go to a restaurant, and I still do it now, actually, something that I can't get out of. I go to a restaurant, I want to be seated with my back against the wall, and I want to be able to see the entry and the exit. It's just something that I can't get out of my system because I
Was
was assessing danger. I was assessing the
that was
danger.
built into you to go into high risk situations, that where you try and de-escalate the situation,
Exactly.
etc. Yeah.
Exactly. So you get triggered by certain set things. So something that happened to me a couple of years ago, which is quite bizarre and it came out of nowhere, was I was involved in something to where there was a high rate of fatalities. And basically the bodies had to be transported to a morgue. And because of the sheer numbers of deceased, they decided to use a refrigerated truck to transport them. So it was a commercial company that they hired it from, and they backed up the truck to the receiving dock at the morgue. But because it was a huge truck, it wouldn't fit in. So basically, what we had to do is we had to take all the bodies off the truck onto dollies, onto gurneys, and transport them a couple of 100 meters to the receiving dock. So sorry. So that happened, and at the time, I didn't think too much of it. I just kind of, okay, that's what we did. Wasn't, and it never really bothered me at the time. Would have been a good 10 years later, driving down the highway and coming up to a truck. It was the same sort of truck that was used to transport. Bang, instant trigger. And I got all the symptoms of PTSD. I got the dry mouth, sweaty palms, high alert. I had these intrusive thoughts about the day. So that's kind of a lot of the stuff that what PTSD will do. Your
Yeah.
hypervigilance is through the roof.
Yeah.
So I virtually didn't venture outside my house for a long, long time. Even when I started to get better, for want of a better term. If I would go to a movie, I'd go to a movie at 11 a.m. on a Tuesday morning when there was probably 12 people in the theatre. The mere thought of going to a movie on a Saturday night with a packed cinema, just I couldn't do it. I physically couldn't do it. So that's some of the things that happen
and
with PTSD.
I assume
and you
that
get
during,
triggers.
I assume during this time you had no idea really what was going on in some sense.
No.
Because it's never happened to you before, in ever.
No.
You're always that person at the front, and that would have been hard for you to even accept that, I imagine.
It wasn't until I started to get education from the doctor that we're going to be speaking about that I started to learn a whole heap of information about why I was reacting the way I was, that it wasn't a weakness, that it wasn't something that I had done.
Yes.
So anyway, but basically during the whole treatment, he did a series of tests, and actually I think he submitted it as a scientific paper where he would get us to do balancing exercises in the shower. He'd also get us to learn how to juggle. So you could imagine I'm in this midst of not knowing what was going on, having all these intrusive thoughts, my whole world turned upside down, and then being told, hey, here's three tennis balls, go and learn how to juggle. It was like bizarre. So, but I was open to anything. I was open to anything to get better, to get back to being the best person I possibly can or possibly could.
How did you get open to that? Because I think this is a big step, isn't it? Honestly, it's a huge
it
step
is,
for
it is,
people
it
to
is.
do that, those exercises, when you don't want to.
It is. No, it is. But I, over a number of years, got a great relationship with this doctor.
Right.
He was very, very good. He was very good. He was a specialist in PTSD for former military, former law enforcement, and just had a great way of working with you. He wasn't judgmental. He was open. He was very down to earth. He was just a great guy and very, very good at what he did. So when I kind of went down the area of starting to drink a bit more than I should have, or started to drink, I really didn't drink much at all, but started to drink, started to self-medicate, he said to me, he said, David, we don't want to get you to the end of the line and then find out we've got to battle this other stuff. So there's a series of self-assessments that you do when you've got PTSD, and I'm not quite sure what the name of it is, but I was starting to score better once I had done those, the juggling and the balancing exercises. So there was certainly something in it, certainly something in it.
And what would you what would you say were some of the?
My hypervigilance was certainly.
Because you're paying attention
certainly
to
down.
Learning to juggle, aren't you? It's
yeah,
it's,
yeah. My
it's
my hypervigilance went down. I can't remember about the intrusive thoughts, but they're the two things that really stuck with me, was the hypervigilance and the memory. Part of the issues with PTSD is you lose your memory. Not lose your memory as in totally, but
no,
you will lose things.
it's that
I remember there
top
was one situation. Yeah, I remember there was one situation where my family and I went away, and probably 6 months later, we were coming back from where we were going and stopped somewhere. And it was like a roadhouse sort of thing. And it was very elaborate the way that it was done. I said, this is amazing. This place is amazing. I said to my wife. And she said, well, you've been here. I said, no, I've never been here before. Never. And she says, yeah, we stopped here on the way back 6 months ago. I said, we have never, ever been here. And then our children were there, and my wife said, have we been here before? Both my children went, yeah, of course we have. We were here about 6 months ago. I had no recollection of it. No recollection of it whatsoever. So
yes.
It does certainly play with your
well,
memory.
Well, there's a connection from the amygdala to the hippocampus, which is where we form new memories. And when you're under stress, obviously those things go offline. So I think that's the beauty of science now, where we can actually see these things and helpfully show people too. What's that the brain is processing everything that's going on around us, and those situations we're in are stressful And so how do we help, and I'm sure you're doing this now, is how do we help people? Because we're always going to have law enforcement and military and first responders and all of us dealing with this. So how do we help people see that and give them the protection and the prevention? So how do we help them do the juggling exercises, not to get them out of something, but to prevent them maybe going in so far to something, is the kind of thinking I have in my mind.
Exactly, exactly. I also think one of the issues with it may have been because it's so simplistic. You know, if it had been a series of medications after a stressful event or something like that, then maybe that would have been welcomed much more than learning how to juggle and doing balancing exercises. They're kind of like,
but I think
it's so simple.
I know, but so is cold therapy, like turning to cold sounds, is people think the same thing, it's too simple. Or the morning routine, taking the panoramic view, which de-escalates the autonomic nervous system. But that's because we don't get taught that. But when you go to the gym and you have a layout of 10 things you've got to do to build your abs or your biceps, no one balks at just doing them.
No, that's right.
That's the difference now. That's the going forward pathway, is like, how do we help people get access to some of these simple understandings that can help them protect them in these positions that they're in, rather than, you know, definitely. What I mean? We don't need to keep going down doing the same thing because we're not willing to help people see and protect people. Do you know what I mean? I think that's how I look at it too.
Mm-hmm.
It must have been wonderful for you to see yourself getting better, because I'm sure you must have been in before, as you started doing these exercises, you were just following instructions, thinking inside, I'll see, but I'm open to anything. And then you probably had this mindset of, well, I've been told this is it. I may not get better. But it must have been an amazing feeling for you to start to see those small changes. It must have been an amazing feeling.
It was. If take me back to the David that I was when I was in the midst of it all, I would not believe that it's the same David that is here today with you. What I was years and years ago to what I am now is a completely different person. And I know that, you know, some people may say, you know, that David's looking through rose-colored glasses. But I think one thing that it's, if I can look at a benefit from what I've gone through, it would have to be now that I have much more empathy than I ever did. Back in those days, I didn't have much empathy whatsoever.
Well, none of us do.
Now I look at it and I have much more empathy.
I don't know if this was you, but in my position, I was running a big lab and raising children and spinning the 10 plates up like you described. And in my mind, it was like, how come no one else can do this? They just don't know how to do it. And I didn't realize the same thing was happening for me too, until they all crashed down. So I think that empathy is really a good word. But, you know, there is a part of the brain that drives empathy. And as you do these exercises, you're actually building the physical connections in your brain that drives empathy and compassion for others. You know, the cold therapy is building empathy. Amazing. Juggling is building empathy because it's a fine motor skill building into the motor cortex, which is where empathy sits.
Okay.
All of these things, you know, and I just think it's amazing that you were able to discover this opportunity to start moving in a new direction through following instructions for those exercises. I think that was something that's very good thing that you did, really.
Yeah, I could have been like so many of my my peers at the time that just kind of threw their hands up and said, I'll have some more beer or some more wine or some more scotch and drown my thoughts and I'm so glad I didn't do it. I'm glad I recognized really early that that's not the path I wanted to go down to.
And would you say that's because you have a tight family support too?
I also think because I was never attracted to that too much.
Yeah.
I was never someone that used alcohol, drugs to a certain extent strongly. It wasn't an interest of mine. My father wasn't a strong drinker.
Right, that helps, doesn't it?
So, So I think that would have really, really helped in the fact that it wasn't an accepted sort of crutch for me to use. So when I did start going down, it was kind of foreign. And I suppose it built a lot of my, I don't want to say self-pity, but a lot of my confidence because I started to use that.
So in terms of alcohol addiction, that's what I study in my research lab. I'm an alcohol addiction neuroscientist, and the bottom line is that alcohol addiction or alcohol addiction, whichever one you call it, is actually the medication, as you call it, for stress and trauma. And we tend to try and stop people drinking, but we don't deal with the stress and trauma. So what you did is you decide to go to the cause and start working out and changing the cause, rather than just trying to keep working, using, you know, looking at the symptoms. So that's a fundamental shift, and it's something that's Gabor Mate talks about, and many, many others in the field talk about this.
Okay.
And we won't ever change addiction until we start changing the causal factors that drive it.
Mm-hmm.
And some people have more underlying, even though they might get PTSD like you later, they may have come in with even more beforehand. If you know what I mean, they might have had more early life experiences that led to a worse outcome for PTSD. So they might need to do 10 times as many exercises as you to make the same recovery. That's the individual difference between us. So after everything you've done and seen in your life, being in the field and trying to keep us safe and all sorts of things, what would you say is the greatest problem facing people right now?
I think there's a gentleman by the name of Graham Burchat. He works with a lot of the top NBA players in obviously the US. And one of his things that he speaks about is next play speed. And what it basically means is that the top performers in NBA in the basketball, we're talking about, you know, Michael Jordan, all those sort of guys, that they will make a mistake, a really bad mistake. They'll miss a shot. They'll miss a pass. They'll pass it out instead of passing to a friend. And within an instant, they are back fully focused on what they're doing. And he's termed it next play speed. So it's like how fast you can get back your full focus onto what your core duties are or your core activities are. I think, and now referring it back to every day, I think that to a certain extent, so many people are having trouble with next play speed. They'll make a mistake in their life and it will take them weeks, months, years to kind of shake it off and then move forward back to where they were going. So,
I love that.
I can really, really see the correlation between sport and the average person, human nature, is that someone will do something stupid and they will think about it and they will ruminate about it and they will live it for the next 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks, 6 years,
well, some
whatever
people,
the case may
yeah,
be.
I can see people grieving for 20 years over a loss.
Exactly. So I kind of look at that is that people need to get that next play speed, but that's not just it. I think that associated with that is fear of rejection, fear of putting themselves out there, fear of what people will say, fear of their friends, their family. So I can kind of see a correlation between those all three things all intertwined, because next play speed is, okay, you've made a mistake. People really don't care. You've made a mistake. Okay, kind of you've made a mistake. They don't care about it. Move forward. But individuals will, as I said, ruminate about it and think about it and polarize themselves for moving forward.
I think there are some things that do take a little bit of time to feel. Like, as you said, you've got to feel some things so that you can recover from them. Otherwise, if you don't feel anything and you just dismiss it too quickly, then it catches up with you later. So it's this combination of, like, I like the analogy, but there's also this component that you're saying that we've got to feel it to heal it is what we call it. So you've got to feel that mistake or feel that but not then leave it there for 20 years.
Exactly.
Is what you're saying.
And exactly
some things
saying.
Are more complicated exactly than others. Some things are really small mistakes that you can just like next play speed. Then there's others that are much bigger that have a big repercussion on many, many people around you.
I'm not for 1 minute thinking that, you know, if you forget to get the milk on the way home, through a mistake, you run over someone and kill them. I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that you just go, okay, well, that's happened, let's move forward.
Yeah.
But I think all of those incidences can be put into like a box, for want of a better term, and say, okay, you forgot the milk. You're not hopeless. You're not losing your mind. Yep. You've simply forgotten the milk. Move forward. And get back to what you're focused on.
I'll remember it next time.
Yeah. And don't beat yourself up about it. Don't give yourself an uppercut and think, you know, don't be too harsh on yourself, because we all know that the biggest critic we've got is the person that looks at us in the mirror in the morning. If someone else spoke to you the way that most people speak to themselves, you'd never speak to them again. So yeah, just be kind and be compassionate to yourself. But I really thought that next play speed was something that was really interesting. That yeah, so many people will make a mistake and dwell on that mistake far too long, and that will hold them back.
I agree with that. And now you're going to go and actually be with Wim Hof in Poland, aren't you? Hopefully, with everything going well next year.
Yes, and I've spoken very much in this conversation about mindset and about what we need to move forward in neuroplasticity. I'm starting to get sweaty hands about it because, yeah, as you know, he takes people up onto an icy mountain, and you're going to be dressed in a pair of shorts and a pair of shoes. You jump into a cold lake for a ridiculous amount of time. So I'm really going to be pushed by it. I'm really going to be pushed by it. But
he does do a lot of training beforehand, doesn't he? Like
he does, yeah. He does.
The breathing.
He does.
And
he does.
But he is a pretty extreme guy, though. He doesn't wait around for anybody, really.
Not at all. Not at all. So it's going to be really interesting. It's going to be really, really interesting. And, yes, I'm looking forward to it. And, yes, I do have some trepidation about it. But I think it will be an incredible experience. And it's similar that we spoke about David Goggins a little bit earlier, that David puts himself into extreme situations, and it's all his mindset. So if I go there with a mindset saying it's going to be too cold, I'm not going to be able to do it, then I probably won't be able to do it.
Well,
if I
that's
go there
true.
With a mindset saying yeah, I'll do it, it will be uncomfortable, it will challenge me, but I'm there for the learning experience.
So for people listening, David, as we close out the podcast, do you want to give someone an idea of what you do every day to maintain a more thriving mindset? Or because, you know, no doubt we want to make sure everyone realizes that this is not something that you did for 10 weeks and now you're better. It's something that you've changed your lifestyle around.
Yeah. Some people would probably call it a little bit extreme. A lot of people talk about having a morning routine. I have a day routine. I check in with myself constantly during the day. I will make sure that my mindset's fine. I'll make sure that my attitude is fine. I'll basically monitor, as we've spoken about a little bit earlier, the next play speed. If something comes up, if an email comes up, or a deal that I'm working on cancels, or something else, you know, bad happens, that I'll acknowledge it. As you said, I'll acknowledge it. Move forward. It's not the end of the world. And then move forward. But yeah, I do the ice immersion, the cold immersion. I'm also a lover of fasting, and I also do the infrared sauna. So the hot and cold sauna as well, or the hot sauna, I should say. So I like to use all the different modalities that are out there to challenge myself. Also, obviously, like to exercise physically. I read. I'm a very keen reader. Love podcasts, and I love basically exploring all the different possibilities there are out there. So I don't have a morning routine. I have a day routine.
I agree with that. But for people wanting to get started, you can just open your eyes and look out the window first. And then this built up over time, no doubt. And I assume, what are your family saying as a response to this turnaround?
My father thinks I'm quite nuts. My father thinks that it's that it's ridiculous. He's an older gentleman, obviously, and all this stuff to him is just kind of hocus pocus. A lot of my friends as well think the same, but I have a core amount of friends who basically do the same thing. We live the same way. So you kind of find your tribe, don't you?
Yes.
And yeah, so yeah, most of us are doing it exactly the same way.
Would you say which way would you prefer to live, I guess, is the question, isn't it?
Oh, live the way that I'm living now, by far. I'm happier. I'm more fulfilled. My brain is I think it's functioning as it should. I'm obviously not 20 anymore, but when I look at speak to other people my age, they complain about sore knees, sore backs, sore elbows. I've got none of that. So many people are on medications. I'm on no medications now.
Well done. That's huge.
Yeah. I monitor my resting heart rate and it's in the mid 50s. So yeah, I'm loving it.
I feel fantastic.
So fulfilled. Yeah.
How long would you say the journey was from the bottom to where you are now? How many years would that
10,
be?
Yeah. 10 easy.
Yeah.
Easily 10 years.
But I mean, it doesn't take 10 years to get to where you are. There were slow changes over each of those time points. So it's important for people to know that they're not looking at a 10-year thing. They're looking at even a month thing can make a difference, like you doing that juggling exercise, for example.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you say 10 years, a decade, it does sound a long time, but that was from the point where I was virtually in the fetal position in my lounge room, not being able to communicate, to sharing this podcast with yourself and everybody who's listening. So it's a huge difference. It's a huge, huge difference from what I was to what I am now. So yeah, it's been gradual, and I'm not saying it's been linear either. There's been ups and downs in the whole journey, but
you're a human. We're human.
Exactly. Exactly. Did I make the right decision in going down the way that I've gone? I think absolutely. I think absolutely. I would hate to see where my life would have been if I had just thrown my hands up and thought, well, this is it.
Thank you so much for doing that. And thank you for all your service all those years.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
That was very kind. That was really great for our society. I'm sorry that you had to go through what you did. I hope we can do better for all of you in the future. And thank you for starting the Dreamers, Believers and Achievers podcast to inspire people. And your own story, of course, inspires, even if it inspires one other person to try something new, that's a big deal. So thank you so much, David, for coming on the Thriving Minds podcast today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I also love the Thriving Minds podcast as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.